The U.S. Poet Laureate asks what we might say to the South Dakota landscape around us. From SDPB, today is Thursday, May 30th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Ada Limon joins us for a look at her signature project as America's official poet. We'll talk about the book You Are Here and nature poems for the world we live in today. That conversation comes near the bottom of the hour. But first, the science of tornadoes. Todd Heitkamp is with us. We'll talk about what Hollywood gets right and wrong, and we'll follow that with an update on gardening and growing for climate uncertainty. Plus, South Dakota Mines President Jim Rankin is retiring. We'll sit down with him this hour as well. We are broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. It is an iconic, if campy, scene. Wide-eyed storm chasers watch as a cow flies across the screen, tossed by a tornado. That is one of the most enduring images from the 1996 blockbuster Twister. Now, a new science on screen event at the Sioux Falls State Theater is asking, how accurate is that movie? Todd Heitkamp is the meteorologist in charge for the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls. He'll give a science presentation before the theater's Twister screening this evening. Todd Heitkamp is with us on the phone. Hey, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me, Laura. I appreciate it.
The trailer for Twister is a little bit traumatizing because any of us who grow up in this part of the world have probably childhood memories of being afraid of a storm and hunkering down in a basement or cellar somewhere. So we'll have some fun with this, but you have to take it pretty seriously, which the people in the film don't always do when it comes to how they prepare for a tornado. So kick us off with some of the things that the film got right and some of the things that the film, like Twister, gets wrong.
Well, I can easily state that or answer that question with one brief statement. What they got, the only thing they got right is that, yes, we do have tornadoes, and yes, we have tornado chasers. That's about it.
That's it. Period.
So, yeah, I mean, they're, you know, obviously, when any time Hollywood gets a hold of something like that, they're going to make it a little bit more extravagant or a little bit more Hollywoodish, if you know what I mean. And that's what the case was here with tornadoes, with Twister. And so, you know, the thing about it is that there's been a lot of changes since that movie came out in 96. I mean, I came here in Sioux Falls in 94, and I've seen a lot of people change their behavior because of that tornado, because of the fact that they had childhood memories, like you said, Lori. I mean, before this movie Twister came out, really all of us that were tornado enthusiasts or had a movie that talked about tornadoes, you have to go back to The Wizard of Oz, and even that was just a brief segment in that movie.
Mm. All right. So what are some of the things that have changed in tornado science? Because one of the things that endures is this idea that we want to be able to predict them, disrupt their path, do something to somehow mitigate the damage. What are scientists trying to do to understand tornadoes?
Well, I think the main thing is to understand. We have a much better understanding of how tornadoes develop since 1996. We can issue those warnings out, especially for these larger tornadoes that are responsible for the majority of the damage that we have seen this spring, you know, such as Greenfield, Iowa, such as Omaha. Those tornado warnings were issued well in advance of those tornadoes actually occurring. So the science behind forecasting tornadoes have gotten a lot better, or at least understanding and then getting those warnings out and in time for people to take action. Now, that's the thing that probably hasn't changed and maybe has even gotten a little bit more worse, is that a lot of times people don't take that message of that tornado coming their way as seriously as what they should, and you know, probably don't prepare themselves for the onset of that tornado. And because there's nothing that we can do to mitigate the damages that results from a tornado or change its path. A tornado is a fact of nature, creation of nature, and it's going to happen no matter what. We just need to basically help ourselves and our family members get out of the way or prepare for its onset.
How good are we at predicting its path?
Well, I think we're you know, pretty good compared to what we were in 96, you know, at that point in time, or even compared back, you know, years before that. We continue to learn something new about tornadoes all the time and the path that they take. But one thing that people need to understand is that radars don't detect tornadoes. Radars detect the circulation from which the tornadoes come from. In order for us to detect a tornado, we would have to have a radar basically almost every 30 miles around the United States, and that's not going to happen, obviously. But the radars have allowed us to really pinpoint down where the circulation is and get a good approximation of where that tornado is and then project its path out from there. And that's where we provide that information in the warnings by listing the cities that are going to be impacted by the tornado and then also giving an approximate time of when that occurrence will happen. So people need to listen to the information that's contained in that warning because that is very valuable information that's going to help protect yourself and your family.
This is a terrible thing that I'm really bad at this. So when I ask these basic questions, I am talking really to people like me who have a tendency to just be clueless about the weather, even if I'm standing in it. So when you have those kinds of warnings, pay attention and take action. What do you want people to know about the kind of action they need to take during a tornado watch?
Well, the tornado watch is basically look around to your surroundings. And, you know, if you're at work, your home, at school, church, wherever it is, where would you seek shelter? Because tornadoes don't occur when it's convenient. They occur when it's inconvenient to you. So minimize that by being more prepared, by looking at your immediate surroundings and try to find out the most you know, structurally sound location that you would go to seek refuge from that tornado. That's the main thing. When you hear the watch, that means conditions are favorable for that tornado to occur. It doesn't mean for certain that it will, but it means you need to start preparing for that at that point in time.
And then you hear a warning for your area. What do you do to take action then?
Plain and simple, take that warning seriously and get yourself and your family members to a place of safety. Avoid the urge of going out and trying to look for it. And everyone, you know, years ago when this movie came out in 96, you had to really go back in your house, so to speak, grab your camcorder, which was a weight of 20 pounds, and put that on your shoulder, and go outside and film it. Now everyone has a camera in their back pocket via their phone. And so a lot of times we're seeing more and more people, and we saw this down in Omaha recently, of people standing outside their houses and videoing recording this tornado as it's approaching. We need to avoid that. We need you to get to your place of safety as soon as possible. The best place to go would be an area below ground, such as your basement, or a room that has no windows, and just wait for the storm to pass. But that's the main thing that you need to do is, number one, believe that it's going to occur and convince yourself that you need to get to your place of safety as soon as you possibly can.
All right, a cow is not going to come flying through your window, but the flying debris that you see in these movies that people often just barely avoid because that's part of the drama. So many people get hurt because there are objects flying through the air. Say something about that so people understand, even if you don't see the twister itself, you might be injured or even killed with some flying debris in high winds.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Lori. That's the main result of all the deaths and injuries. Tornadoes don't kill people. It's the flying debris that injures and kills people. And so that's what you need to protect yourself from. That's one thing that's, you know, depicted wrongly in the movie Twister. Though, you know, all these people are subjected to all this debris and they come out unscathed and maybe a little bit of mud on their face or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's not a real case scenario. You need to protect yourself from the debris, and that's why we tell people to seek shelter underground, you know, in your basement, because that's going to at least provide a little bit of protection of that debris going over the top of you. And so those are the things that you need to keep in mind. You know, also a lot of times they'll talk about in this movie seeking shelter underneath a bridge or an overpass. That's one of the worst things that you can do because you're going to be subjected to stronger winds and more debris. So you're exactly right. We need to protect ourselves from the debris. And a lot of times people will have bicycle helmets or football helmets, if you can imagine, in their basement or their shelter location to put over their child's head because you need to protect their head from that flying debris.
Yeah. If you are caught out in your car, what are you supposed to do if you don't go to an underpass?
Well, you know, this is the whole thing, is that we need to be more proactive in thinking about where we're driving into. You know, look out ahead. We all have a phone, a smartphone. If you have someone driving with you, have them look at the radar, see what's going on. Our phones can be alerted by the warning messages that the Weather Service sends out. If you're heading into that storm, maybe you need to stop driving and move into shelter locations like a town or whatever and wait for that storm to pass. If you have no other option, and I mean no other option, there's no other farm or building that you could drive to and take shelter there, what we recommend you to do is to take shelter in a ditch, a low-lying area, like a ravine, and cover your head with your hands and hope that nothing happens. But that is the ultimate last thing that you should ever do. But definitely avoid the overpass.
Yeah, you're in big trouble then if that's what happens. So
yes,
prepare.
Exactly right.
pay attention. Todd Heitkamp, a meteorologist in charge for the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls, we appreciate this. The number of lives that you've probably saved just by saying the same things over and over again cannot be overstated. So thanks for doing that for us today.
Well, I appreciate that, Lori, and thanks for having me.
Summer gardening season is in full swing. Flowers are blooming, produce growing, and the weather has been mostly mild. But changing climates and severe weather pose obstacles for gardeners. Arlene Brandt Jensen is president of Minnehaha Master Gardeners and former conservationist with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. She's also been involved with the Soil and Water Conservation Society. And she's with me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio right now. We're going to talk a little bit about severe weather, extreme weather, climate change, and gardening and growing.
Sure.
We live in this this world that is not maybe the same world that our grandmothers gardened in, including some changes with the zones and the temperatures that we're seeing. Tell us a little bit about what has changed recently about how we plan for gardening in this climate.
Okay. Well, that is true. The USDA plant hardiness zones have changed. They came out with a new map in 2023. And actually, now I believe kind of about the bottom third of South Dakota is now in zone 5A, which what that means is it's the average annual extreme minimum temperature from that average is based from 1991 to 2020. So that temperature is minus 20 to minus 15 Fahrenheit.
So we're getting a little warmer.
We are getting a little warmer,
We're getting a little warmer. So when we plant and grow and garden, what are some of the things that we need to think about to make a resilient gardening landscape?
Okay. Well, you know, one maybe benefit is we could try something that's wasn't hardy in our area before. You know, maybe a zone 5 would have been out of the question, but now maybe you could try a zone 5 plant, a perennial plant. But it's not so much the plant hardiness zones that we need to think about, it's the extremes. We get extreme heat, we get extreme rain, extreme wind. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I know South Dakota has a lot of wind, but man, every day it seems like it's really windy. So as far as gardening for that, there's little things we can think about in, you know, taking, you know, if plants are damaged by wind, you can maybe, you know, snip off the damaged areas, prune damaged plants. One thing about trees in your landscape, trees need to be pruned. And if they are left unpruned and they're, you know, just a solid mat of branches that are tangled up, the wind can't get through that as easy, and you'll end up with more branches breaking. Okay. And that's especially true with a young tree, to start pruning early so you open up the shape of that tree.
Do you cover things, bring them inside? How do you plan for some of those extreme weather events beyond the, you know, container gardens? And
Right. Once your garden's in the ground, you can't do a whole lot about, you know, hail or extreme right. wind or extreme rain, which, you know, we could get too much and or not enough. If you get too much rain and you've got plants in the ground, you could pull back the mulch if you have mulch around the plants to try to dry up the soil a little bit. If you've got pots that have that are just inundated and soaked, you could try to tip the pot over to drain some of the excess water. Of course, obviously, make sure you have drainage holes in all your pots. Watering. You know, if we don't have enough rain, the best way to water your garden is on the ground, not with a big overhead sprinkler that you're pulverizing the soil with.
Okay.
Either using soaker hoses or just like a soaker setting on your wand to water the plant at the root. You don't need to water the leaves. That's not where the plant takes in the moisture.
Yeah. All right. Good tips for now. We're keeping it short today, but it's, the summer has begun.
Okay.
So we will have more of these tips throughout the summer as we continue the program. Arlene Brandt Jensen, thanks so much for today. We'll see you next time.
I'd be glad to be back, Lori.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Jim Rankin is president of South Dakota Mines and has been at the helm since 2018. But this summer, after 6 years of leadership, he is retiring. President Rankin is joining us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Jim Rankin, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
I was able to go back and take a look at our first conversation when you were stepping into the role, and we talked about everything from flying cars to businesses in in South Dakota that would kind of keep those mines graduates nearby and creating innovation in a way that was self-sustaining. I don't know that we made a lot of progress on flying cars since 2018, but perhaps we did on business and innovation in the Black Hills. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, I think the flying cars have moved along, but we have not seen too many of them in South Dakota yet. So hopefully that's not too far in the future. But a lot of what we've done is the innovation activity, and we've really ratcheted up the research. I think in the 6 years that I've been there, we've almost doubled the research. And you might wonder, well, why is that important? Well, when you're doing that research, you're coming up with innovations, things that you can file patents on. And if you can start down that patent process, now you can license it to hopefully a startup company. And then we have faculty and graduate students who would like to start a company, and we want them to be right here in South Dakota. So that creates jobs. So really, research is the startup of more jobs in South Dakota. And so we've been it's been good to see that really take a leap forward.
Your tenure at Mines is, of course, punctuated by the pandemic, and there were certain things you clearly had to pivot and deal with, but were there opportunities and innovations that came out of that time that, even if maybe you had to struggle with some of your enrollment goals that were impacted by the pandemic, you made advances in other ways that you couldn't have foreseen in 2018 when you arrived?
Yeah, when I first got here, you know, really I had about three goals that I was really interested in. That was to see research increase. I wanted to see the fundraising that we do increase, and wanted to see enrollment increase. And, you know, as we just mentioned, research went up, and our fundraising is more than doubled in the 6 years that I've been here. It's just great to see that support for the university. Enrollment, we didn't quite get that increase we were looking for. But on the other hand, we'd put an enrollment strategic plan in place, and I think that helped us not go down as much as some other universities did. So from that point, it was a success. It just didn't grow as much as we were hoping for.
We also spoke in the beginning about diversity initiatives, and you were saying at the time that if you weren't bringing students into a diverse environment, you were not helping them to start careers in the most fulfilling way. Obviously, the politics of diversity initiatives in universities have also changed since then, but the idea has not changed much. So tell me a little bit about how, over the past 6 years, you have looked at the ratio of men to women and the number of Native American engineers you're turning out, and what has the progress on that been?
Yeah, we've continued to increase in those areas. Our male-to-female ratio is 3-to-1, which may not sound that great, but if you talk to some of our alums from 10, 20, 30 years back, they're amazed that we're at 3-to-1. And, you know, we need to keep working to get closer to 1-to-1 so that we're even there. I think if you look at a lot of universities across the nation, female is about 60 to 65%. So we've got a ways to go, and we really want to encourage more women to go into the STEM field. So that is an area we need to keep working. Native American, we've got our Teal Space Center, and we're trying to do what we can to increase the number of Native American students that come to mines. And then just diversity, you know, diversity takes a lot of different steps. You know, growing up in a town of 200 and in a town of 1,000, coming to Rapid City is a big place. You take a look at folks that come out of Denver and come up here, this is kind of a smaller place. And so you get a lot of different viewpoints on where people come from. And, mm-hmm. you know, for those folks that don't land a job in South Dakota, and I think right now about 39 to 40% of our students after they graduate stay in South Dakota, but you're likely going to go to a multinational corporation and you're dealing with employees and teams around the world from different cultures and different backgrounds. And I think the more that we can help expose people to that kind of environment is really good for all of us.
What kind of advice would you give to the next president? I know a search will be underway and a new person will be found. What would you want to leave behind for that person if you could put a note on their desk?
You know, that's a loaded question. You know, it's a great place, and I think the person coming in is going to recognize that. We've just got outstanding faculty and staff, and the students, they just do a great job. And, you know, we provide an education that's going to help students go out. We tell them, we expect you to go out and change the world. And so that's kind of what we look at. And so I'm expecting the next president will come in and do that same thing and continue to make improvements above what I tried to do. So I think there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of upside for whoever the next president is.
Tell us a little bit about, you mentioned fundraising, the kinds of stories that people were telling you, the kind of community support Mines has. What were you hearing?
There was a Wall Street Journal article, I think it was just, I don't know, 5-6 months ago. They surveyed alumni and they surveyed students and just asked, well, would you recommend your university to other people? South Dakota Mines ended up tied for 9th in the nation for recommendations from other folks. And then they broke that down even further to the Midwest. And we came in 2nd in the Midwest, beating a small school, I think, called University of Notre Dame. Which I thought was pretty interesting. Hmm. So we've got a lot of very dedicated alumni out there that are very supportive of the university and the education that they've got. And they look for ways to give back, whether it's coming to the classroom to talk, whether it's coming for their company to recruit students to come work for them, or, you know, other ways that they can help out the university. So we really do have a loyal alumni base, and they're scattered not only across South Dakota, but across the nation. And we have about 500 alums that live in Norway, so we're actually across the world.
What will you do next? Are you going to stick around the Black Hills?
Well, I'm a believer that the past president shouldn't stick around to be in the hair of the next president. So we will head out of South Dakota, although it's been great to be back in the Black Hills and hopefully to be passing through here often in the future. But for right now, we're not planning to stick in South Dakota.
All right. Do you still have your Mines beanie or your senior hat, or is there a senior hat that they give the president as he's out the door? I feel like
they did not give me a senior hat, okay. But I still have the one from back in the 70s, and I do have the beanie from way back in the 70s. Although they did give me a new one when I walked in the door here. So,
right.
Yeah, great traditions, and I think you know the students still enjoy doing that, and it's a great way for them to meet the upperclassmen and just get a chance to become part of the family on campus.
Yeah. President Jim Rankin with South Dakota Mines, thank you so much for being here with us, too, on the air throughout the past 6 years. We really appreciated getting to know you, and good luck in the days ahead.
Well, thank you for that, and thank you for supporting not only South Dakota Mines, but all the regional universities that we have across South Dakota, because that support is really important to all of us.
We appreciate that. We'll see you next time. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The poetry anthology, You Are Here, asks readers to pay deep attention to the natural world. It's part of U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limon's signature project. You Are Here is published by Milkweed Press out of Minnesota. I talked with Ada Limon over Zoom earlier this week about her work as a poet and as U.S. Poet Laureate. We began with Milkweed Press and the power of a small Midwestern house in shaping America's literary conversation.
They've been a really beautiful press to work with. My first book with them was Sharks and Rivers, and it came out in September of 2010. Wow. So we've had quite a long relationship. My second book with them was Bright Dead Things, which was 2015, which was the book that was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award, a National Book Award, and the Kingsley Tufts. And so that book kind of hit the ground running, if you will. It was sort of my first book that received any kind of major attention. And then I stayed with them, and we did The Carrying after that, and then The Hurting Kind. You know, when it came to doing an anthology with the Library of Congress for the signature project You Are Here, it just made sense to stay with not only a press that feels very near and dear to me in terms of its people and its staff and, you know, its incredible editors and publisher, but also because of its list and its dedication to environmental justice, you know, talking about indigenous wisdom. I'm thinking about the incredible book Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer, which is also on that list. And its dedication to indigenous wisdom and the ecological practices of our time. And so I think it made sense to stick with the press that has such a beautiful mission, as well as just really beautiful human beings behind each of their books.
I was listening to your conversation also in Minnesota with Krista Tippett for On Being, and you were talking about The Hurting Kind and the pandemic. And during the pandemic, there was this time when everybody stayed home across the world and wild creatures retook wild spaces in the middle of the city. You know, foxes were down the street and dolphins were in canals, and everyone was reporting on what they had seen. And so it strikes me that You Are Here is also a response to the pandemic in some ways. It is different maybe than it would have been if we had not gone through that collective time together. Because now it seems to me that we've just gone back to even more of a frenzy of hurrying and rushing than we were before. And we are careening in this climate crisis at the same time. So tell me a little bit about the anthology and what you wanted to invite other poets to express to you when you were asking them to send in poetry for the collection.
That's a really wonderful question, because I think one of the things that I'm very aware of, and maybe we all are feeling on some level, is that, you know, we went through the pandemic and we isolated, and we had this moment where many of us had the privilege to stand still. You know, we thought of it as being a burden, but in many ways, there were so many first responders and essential workers that not only were not standing still or taking a breath, but were in fact working harder than they ever had in very precarious situations. And so some of us had the opportunity to stop whether that was just to, you know, move our work online or to actually just take a moment to recognize where we were in our lives. And I think one of the biggest things that came out of that for me was that idea of interconnectedness, that in a deep isolation, my husband was often traveling, so it was just me. I really recognized that I was never alone, that I was part of this planet, and that my daily routines were taking place with the birds' daily routines, with the plants' daily routines. My seasons were interconnected to everyone's seasons, whether we were going through an ice storm here in Kentucky or if we were suddenly going through spring and everything was out and loud and chaotic and, you know, humming along. And I think one of the biggest regrets that I have collectively is that I don't think we took a moment to transition in any way once the pandemic lessened and, you know, our cases went down and people returned to quote unquote normal. Because I felt like we, first of all, didn't grieve. I don't think we grieved our great losses. And I also don't think we spent time recognizing a real big question, which is, what do you want to leave here and what do you want to take with you from this experience? And I think for me, it was the importance of slowing down. It was the importance of rest. It was the importance of awareness and attention and that deep commitment to our interconnectedness that felt like I really wanted to hold on to. And what I wanted to leave was that urge for everything to be going at a pace in which we can't keep up with, for everything to be moving at a speed which not only is driven by the hedonic treadmill for pleasure and more, but also driven by our need to procure and to make and for everything that we do to be measured by productivity. And so I needed to make a book that really recognized that, to come back to what is a new nature poem for this moment right now, to have gone through the pandemic. Luckily, I came out of it okay, and many of us did. Then to also be at this new moment where we're recognizing with more clearer eyes than ever where we are in terms of the climate crisis. We can't go back to the same nature poem that we might have studied in graduate school or undergraduate, some of those beautiful, you know, romantic poets, you know, whether it was Wordsworth or even Larry Levis talking about stars, or even some of our, you know, more contemporary poets. I think even Mary Oliver, whose poetry I love, we often can't go even back to her. Because we've got to move forward in a way where our poetry reflects where we are, not just as artists, but as people living on this planet at this moment and responding to it with our whole heart and our whole mind, with an openness that is receiving our reality. Hmm.
You get to talk to climate scientists, too, as you work on the poem that opens the National Climate Assessment Report. Mm-hmm. And they told you something similar, as I understand it, in the sense that they did not want whatever you did for them to be something that looked backward or was nostalgic. What did you learn from them about what they wanted, what scientists wanted from you as a poet and from poetry?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Doing the poem for the National Climate Assessment was really one of the great honors that I've had in the last couple of years. And, you know, when I met with those climate scientists, one of the biggest things was that kept coming up over and over again was that it's really about mitigation and adaptation. It's not necessarily about a returning. That doesn't mean that there can't be regeneration and repair work, but it really is about mitigation and adaptation. How do we move forward? How do we move forward together? And how do we take this new reality and do the best we can for all of us on the planet, not just those of us in the United States, but everywhere on this earth, and not just the human animals, but all of the living beings. That was the biggest thing for me, was that it's no longer about returning to where we were, but instead about really recognizing our new reality and moving forward in a way that is smart, and also in a way that's clear-eyed and wholehearted.
I want to ask you about form as a reader. When you're reading a poem and you're following the narrative and it's speaking to you, and maybe you hear some words that are rich in your ears or that feel good to read aloud, but then you're at that next level where you say, I don't understand the white space here. I don't understand why she used these line breaks. And I know enough to know that maybe this is a form, but I'm not going to recognize what it is. How do you read poetry when you're at that point and you want to learn a little more and understand a little more deeply about how it is crafted so eloquently, but you don't even know where to start because you're not going to necessarily take a master's level, poetry class? Does that make sense as a question to you that has an answer?
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful question, because I think that, beyond the sort of first interaction with poetry where you think, oh, okay, I'm going to sort of try to understand this. And I think when we think about understanding, we have to stop thinking about understanding necessarily with our structured brain, but instead to absorb poetry the way that we might absorb walking into a forest, or the way that we might hear music, that there will be things that we don't understand, and there will be things that do make total sense to us. And we can pay attention to both of those things. If you are at a place that you really are receptive to poetry already, you enjoy it, you like reading it, but you're still kind of like, oh, how do I go deeper? How do I maybe teach myself to read this on a different level, or to expand my own horizon when it comes to the poetic form? The first thing to do would be to recognize how it makes you feel, and to sit with that. Go, oh, okay, this is how it's making me feel. Oh, this is interesting. And then to also look for patterns. The patterns are sometimes what we notice in nature, and they're also the same things that we'll notice in poems when they sort of come to the surface, whether a word is repeated, whether a sentiment is repeated, whether there is some sort of line break that keeps happening, whether it's couplets or tercets or happening in twos or threes, if you want to put it more plainly, to look at patterns and then to think about what that intentionality might be around those patterns. That's a nice way to enter the poetic form. But above all, I would really want people to receive it the way they receive music, which is really with our hearts and our feeling center versus our analytic center.
I spent a lot of time with your poem Obedience this weekend, and found it, and maybe you can say more about this, but the way it was affecting me physically indicated to me that I was grieving the loss of my dog, or I was feeling, who died, before the pandemic. So the things that can come up for us when we spend a certain amount of time. So thank you for that poem, first of all. When you see that grief coming up, or you feel that joy or that laughter or that recognition where you rush out and you want to read it to someone else, what do you do with that when it's showing up in your body?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you just made, is that I can have an intention around what I write. And I do have an intention around what I write, what I make. Everything's thoughtfully wrought, if you will. But then when I hand it to someone else, when you're sitting alone and reading that poem, Obedience, for example, which is about my dog is snoring next to me at the moment. she's a 13-year-old pug. That poem becomes yours now. And whatever is happening in your body, whatever you're holding onto, whether it's in your chest or what you have been receiving or holding, that's going to affect how that poem is for you and how you respond to that poem. And that's one of my favorite things about the exchange of the poem once I've written it and you receive it, is that the poem then is yours. And it's your job to let your body react to it however you want. And that kind of enthusiasm and release and kind of an energetic exchange, if you will, I think is really important to the art form itself, is that at some point it's no longer mine, but it becomes yours. And it becomes about your dog enters it, right?
Yeah.
Your grief enters it. And that is so beautiful, because it's like I've made a forest and you've gotten to walk into it. And everything that you've carried with you is with you in that moment of stillness.
Yeah. To the point when you pick up your dog in the poem, my dog couldn't be picked up. So when you said it was a pug, I was like, oh, that does make sense now. Because it occurs to me that in my mind, I was like, how would that happen? Because I had internalized it that much, that it would not have been super easy to scoop her into my arms because she was slightly bigger than your dog. So I love that. That's so delightful. I just made that connection.
Thank you for sharing that with me. I love that too. And that's how I relate to poems, is that there is a level that feels deeply personal.
Yeah.
And so enough so that sometimes when you hear a writer talking about their poems, you think that's wrong. I know how that poem is.
Yeah.
And so I think that is also, you know, it's not talked about enough when we talk about poetry. Is that beautiful magic moment where my work ends and the reader's work begins.
In order to get to that point, you had to say at some point that poem was ready for the transfer. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you get asked a lot, how do you know when a poem is done? Because this is one of the things that poets struggle with. Mm-hmm. But if you never say that it is ready to share, then I never get to have that moment, and Milkweed never publishes your book, and you never, you know. So at some point you have to make that step. How do you think about, how have you thought about that throughout your career as a poet? And how do you think about it now, that moment when you say this is enough, or this is done, or this is ready, or however you think about it?
You know, it changes, I think, with each poem, and each poem has different signals it sends you. But for the most part, I know when it's done is when I read it out loud many times and I feel like the music is working in tandem to lift up the images and any kind of internal work that's happening on the page. So it's really about that auditory experience for me when I read it out loud, that it feels like every line is supposed to be where it's supposed to be. And not every poet is like this, and not every poem for me is like this. But oftentimes I'm also looking for, does it make a kind of pulsating sense? I don't mean like sense like a paragraph or prose, a meaning that I know. And, you know, there are many poets that would maybe work against meaning a little bit more. But oftentimes I'm not doing that. I'm trying to look for a type of clarity that explains something that I could not explain in prose. And if I read it out loud enough, then eventually I think, oh, okay, there's nothing more to go in it, and there's nothing more to take from it, and it's complete. So I think of it less about being done and more about it being complete or whole.
I love that. You mentioned the forest that I get to walk through, and you say, in the introduction of "You Are Here," in order to have one tree flourish, we must plant more around it. The same must go for poems. And you've invited people with this prompt to create their own work. Tell us a little bit about that as part of your Poet Laureate project.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, for my signature project called You Are Here, there's two elements of it. And one of them is this anthology, which includes 50 original contemporary poems that are new nature poems, if you will, by incredible writers. And then the next part is that I'll be visiting seven different national parks around the country, and there'll be seven different poetic installations in each of these national parks. And I get to go visit them and unveil these poetic installations, and then also encourage people on each of the installations. It says just a very simple prompt. It says, "What would you say to the landscape around you?" So I'm encouraging people to write their own poem. And if poetry is really intimidating to you, there's a reason I said you can write a poem, but you can also, what would you say, is to really respond to the natural world wherever you are. And it could be that you live in a very urban space. I lived in Brooklyn for years, so I'm very familiar with finding nature in urban spaces. And it could be that you live in a more rural area. And for me, each one provides a different kind of connection. So if you can find something to pay attention to and respond to it with writing your own poem, that I think that would be a beautiful way to connect to the wonder of this world. So I've encouraged anyone, if they want to, over the summer or anytime, to write their own You Are Here poem. They can share it if they want with the hashtag You Are Here Poetry. You know, they can put it on social media, but also I know social media can be a disaster. So they can also share it with their friends and their loved ones and read it to a tree or set it in their burn pile and know it once existed, whatever it is that that does your heart the most benefit. But the big thing is to pay deep and close attention to the world around you, because paying attention is also a way of loving.
Would you read something for South Dakota today? I would greatly appreciate that. Yeah,
I would love to. And I want to add that in all my travels, and I've traveled a lot as a writer, as a poet, and especially in this current role as the Poet Laureate, I want to add that I've never been to South Dakota. So if anyone wants to invite me to join you in South Dakota, I would come, because I have never been. And so I need to check that off my list.
We are on it. We are on that so quickly and enthusiastically.
Beautiful. I will, because we talked about it, mm-hmm. I would love to read Obedience, if that's okay with you.
Thank you. I would love that.
Obedience. The dog lifts her head from the piles of dead leaves, and at first she is calm until she is not. She can't find me. Not behind the cypress or the still bare viburnum. Betrayer, I am watching from the window, warm behind the doorframe. What is it to be wholly loved like this? God, how desperate she is to find me. Walking toward her, I watch her whole body vibrate when I come into focus. I lift her into my arms because it is what I want. Who doesn't want to hold their individual God, to be redeemed by pleasing the only one you serve?
That is U.S. Poet Laureate Ada Limón. If you like that conversation, you might like to join me in the studio for a conversation with South Dakota One Book author Trent Presler. That is coming up on June 25th in the Sioux Falls Studios at 6 p.m. But the spaces are somewhat limited, so I need you to go to sdpb.ticketbud.com and reserve your spot. Trent Presler is kicking off the One Book author tour in South Dakota. He's going across the state, but he starts at SDPB here in conversation with us. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's In the Moment, we'll get ready for live music that defines summer across the state.
Terrence Simeon is with us. We'll also preview Claire Lockhart's Thunder Domesticity and Art in Vermilion, and we'll check in on what we know about the science of discovery in the Badlands and a new genus of tiny deer. It's all coming up on In the Moment tomorrow. From all of us at SDPB, thanks for listening.